Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, and the national debt, and more. And you'll hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. This is a special edition of Facing the Future. Your regular host, Chase Hageman, is out for the week. In fact, he's on paternity leave. You might say he's facing his own future this week. So while Chase deals with that, I'm Bob Bixby, Executive Director of the Concord Coalition, and I'll be the guest host this week. Today, I'll be joined on the show by Josh Gordon, a familiar name and a familiar voice to listeners of Facing the Future. But there's a little bit of a twist this week. Josh Gordon is no longer policy director of the Concord Coalition. Gasp. He is now executive vice president and director of policy and research at Free the Facts. Josh, welcome back to Facing the Future.
It's a pleasure to be back, Bob.
It's you're at FTF, and you're back on FTF, and they're different FTFs.
Yes, it's caused confusion in my brain for a month already.
Well, as if there wasn't enough there already. But anyway, we'll get to that later. The transition from the Concord Coalition to Free the Facts. And before we get there, though, the fiscal year ended September 30th. The Treasury Department put out the final numbers for the year just last week on Friday afternoon. It was interesting. They buried the numbers on Friday afternoon in classic style, and it confirmed an earlier CBO estimate that the budget deficit last year was $984 billion, 4.6% of GDP. It's, I think, the fourth year in a row that the deficit has gone up as a share of the economy. Outlays totaled $4.4 trillion. That is about, it's almost 21% of GDP. Revenues were considerably lower, $3.4 trillion in 2019, and essentially flat as a percentage of GDP at 16.9%. Actually, just a tad lower, measured as a share of the economy, than they were the year before. So rapidly rising spending and not rapidly rising revenues lead to a bigger deficit and a bigger debt. Josh, were there anything about these numbers that stood out to you?
Well, as you said, the first thing that stood out to me was that the administration released these about 2.5 weeks later than normal, and I found myself every day refreshing the browser to see when this final numbers would come out. So luckily, they finally came out, which means everyone can update their pie charts, and that's one of the things that I know Concord does right away. So other than that, I think the thing that stood out is the thing that budget wonks have been talking about for a couple years, that we're in a very low unemployment economy. The economy is growing. You can consider this at, you know, the peak of the business cycle, and yet we still have growing deficits, which is really unusual. So that's a little dispiriting. I also, as you were reading the percent of GDP numbers, am struck that we are at about our average outlays and average revenues, a little bit below average revenues if you look historically over the last 40 years. And those averages take into account the highs of the business cycle and the lows of the business cycle. And even though we're at the high of the business cycle, we're still with this, 4% of GDP deficit, which is pretty disheartening if you look at projections for the future and slower economic growth in the future and the possibility of a recession in the future. This is the time when we really should be shrinking our budget deficit, and we're not doing that. So I think that's really the standout picture from these numbers.
Yeah, I think that's what people have been commenting about is the unusual phenomenon of having a budget deficit going up in a strong economy and revenues being flat, essentially. I mean, they go up in nominal terms, but staying flat and staying flat at a level that's below where they have been on average. And the of course, the problem is that as the population ages and a lot of the spending increase is due to the major benefit programs like Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid, those that go up on autopilot. And if revenues are staying at below a historic level and spending is rising to, automatically, outside of the appropriations process, that's why it's by definition on an unsustainable path because the deficit is growing faster than the economy. And one consequence of that is that interest costs on the debt go up by quite a bit. What were the interest costs this year?
At the end of the fiscal year, it looked like we spent about $376 billion on interest on the debt. That's up about $50 billion from what we spent in 2018 on interest on the debt. And it's about $110 billion higher than what we spent in 2017 on interest on the debt. So interest costs are going up, even though we have pretty low interest rates and a growing economy. So I think that is concerning because, of course, that's money that is not being put to more productive use, either in investments or being kind of saved by helping reduce the deficit. So I think that's concerning. The other thing that struck me was if you look at corporate revenues, they were down by about 20% from what they were projected to be before the 2017 tax cut. And, you know, the corporate income tax revenues are something that fluctuates along with economic growth. And this is another one of those really dramatic pictures where you have economic growth, but plummeting corporate tax revenue. And that's largely because Congress cut taxes in 2017. And clearly we're experiencing revenue loss because of that.
So is it fair to say that the tax cut enacted in 2017 is not paying for itself?
Yes, Bob, it is very fair to say that.
I learned in law school to ask leading questions.
We never thought the tax cut would pay for itself. Nonpartisan economic analysis did. But I think what I think might be surprising is that we might have a situation where the tax cut is going to cost more than the Congressional Budget Office or the Joint Tax Committee projected. And I think that is really worrisome.
Well, one of the things that I think confuses people is that you look at the numbers and revenue did go up. And so people would say, well, no, we didn't lose money. We didn't, revenues are going up. So how can you say that revenues fell? And what that is measuring is the difference between nominal intake on revenue and revenue as a percentage of the economy and also what revenues would have been otherwise. And I was looking at the numbers a bit just to look at 2019, which is the year that just ended, when this administration and this Congress took office in January of 2017, the Congressional Budget Office was projecting that the deficit in 2019, would be $600 billion. And as we just said, it turned out to be $984 billion. So a lot of that, really most of it, the change is from legislative changes that is to say tax cuts or higher spending. And if you look at the adjustments that have been made to the CBO baseline, it's roughly about a 70-30% split. In other words, revenue changes, legislative changes account for about 70% of the change, and higher spending about 30% of the change. So, you know, yeah, Congress and the administration have both raised spending and cut revenues that have increased the deficit, which is a really incredibly irresponsible thing to do when you already have, you come into office with an already unsustainable situation and a pretty bad outlook and proceed to make it worse. But, you know, so I don't know when it's ever going to change course, but right now it's important to note that, you know, this is not just happening on its own. As a matter of fact, the so-called economic and technical changes that CBO have made to the baseline have actually improved the budget picture. And part of that is CBO thinks that there's a feedback effect to the economy from cutting taxes and increasing spending. But it just doesn't pay for itself. So maybe people are beginning to understand that. I'm not sure. This is Facing the Future. I'm Bob Bixby, and I'm talking to Josh Gordon, Executive Vice President and Director of Policy and Research at Free the Facts. Josh, they're now turning their attention to fiscal year 2020. Of course, they should have passed all of the annual appropriations bills by the end of the last fiscal year to fund 2020. That ended on September 30th. None of the bills had been passed by both the House and Senate at that time. And here we are towards the end of October. Congress is working off of a so-called continuing resolution, which funds the government at roughly the same level as last year's programs until that CR runs out. And that CR runs out on November 21st. What happens if Congress doesn't pass any of these appropriation bills by then?
Well, if they don't pass the appropriations bills, you have a government shutdown. And we've experienced government shutdowns and threats of government shutdown for, you know, the last 3 years at least, and really going back 10, 15 years. There's always some kind of threat here for government shutdown. I think the interesting thing is, you know, from a fiscal perspective, they've already decided on how much to spend. And so now the question is, can they actually get these bills through without, you know, political debates over kind of extraneous positions not directly related to funding levels? And that could be anything from we had a government shutdown because of border wall spending before. I think that's probably going to be an issue again. And then there are other questions about whether they're going to be, you know, political pieces to these appropriations bills, or whether they'll just try and get as many done as possible, because no one really likes running the government through continuing resolutions. It hamstrings agencies in figuring out how they want to use their resources for the future. And, you know, there are actually studies that the more you govern by continuing resolution, the more expensive government actually is because of a lot of that short-sightedness. So really, we'd like them to pass these appropriations as soon as possible, so we don't have to worry about the threat of a government shutdown.
And they could hypothetically pass some and not pass others. So some of the government would be shut down and some of it wouldn't be. That's what happened last January. I think you mentioned the border wall funding. That's likely to be a big sticking point, as it was last year. Thrown into the mix this year that makes it more complicated is that if you kind of read the tea leaves and the timelines, you may be looking at impeachment votes around the same time as the vote on spending. And I don't know how that's going to play out. People are beginning to wonder, you know, there's one thing to walk and chew gum at the same time. Dealing with a government shutdown and impeachment at the same time seems like something of a time bomb or something. I'm not sure exactly. That would be, I think, fairly unprecedented. I can't remember it. And I don't know how that would play out.
well, hopefully we won't have to find out. They can get these appropriations bills off the table and then turn to whatever other business they want to turn to. But really,
yeah,
this should be a priority.
If I were there, I would be pushing for a long-term CR. Not that that's a good way to govern. It's not. But getting this issue off the table maybe into next year might be a sound way to go. Well, whatever they do, hopefully they'll at least get funding and avoid a government shutdown. There are other fiscal deadlines that are coming up, maybe not quite as urgent, but certainly important. And there's a bill that was introduced this week with the name of the Time to Rescue United States Trust Act. It's called the Trust Act, and it's designed to prevent the pending depletion of a couple of key federal trust funds, such as the Medicare Part A Trust Fund and the two Social Security Trust Funds. We tend to think of it as one, but it's really two. It's the Old Age and Survivors Insurance Trust Fund and the Disability Insurance Trust Fund. And then there are the Highway Trust Funds. So there are basically four trust funds that are very important, and they all have funding problems, meaning that they could all face depletion by 2032 or 2033, depending upon whose numbers you look at. But this is a bill, this Trust Act, is designed to help come up with solutions to extend the solvency of these trust funds. And it's kind of a unique process that they've come up with. Have you had a chance to look at it, Josh, this Trust Act?
Yeah, I looked it over, and I think what is most interesting is that they're dividing up these committees to save these trust funds, and on each of them, you'll have bipartisan members of Congress forming these committees to figure out how to deal with these trust funds kind of by themselves. And this is actually something Concord doesn't often talk about. We like to look at the budget as a whole and how all these things interact. But I think from a political standpoint, there is some promise to just having these bipartisan groups of legislators meet to figure out how to make each of these trust funds sustainable over the longer term. And maybe that's kind of the magic ticket to unlock bipartisan agreement in ways that we haven't seen in Washington before, or at least not over the last 10 or 20 years. And these are certainly urgent problems. So whatever Congress comes up with that forces them to deal with these problems in a timely manner, I think can only help us for the future.
Well, I've been looking for that magic, would you call it a magic carpet or
golden
magic
ticket? Or,
yeah, magic ticket. I've been looking for that for a long time. I like it too. I find myself, I just have to confess, you know, every time I hear about special committees or commissions or anything like that, I do roll my eyes. On the other hand, there's no point defending the regular process because the regular process has gotten us nowhere. So, and it doesn't appear likely to. So, to take a step back and look at this bill, and I should mention it was it's being put forward by Senators Romney and Manchin, Democrat and Republican, and also Young from Indiana and Jones from Alabama, another Democrat and Republican. So it's got bipartisan buy-in, and Representative Gallagher in the House and Ed Case also in the House, and they're a Republican and a Democrat as well. So the intent is to have a bipartisan process, and so there are bipartisan co-sponsors. And of course, that's always been an important thing for the Concord Coalition. And the mechanism that they came up with is to have the congressional leadership appoint 12-member rescue committees, they call them, for each of these endangered trust funds. So I guess that would mean four different committees for these four different trust funds. And they would each have equal membership between Democrats and Republicans. they would have 12 members, and they would have bipartisan co-chairs. And the interesting thing is that in order for a rescue plan to be adopted by the committee, it would have to have a majority vote, but the majority would have to include two members, at least two members from each party. So you couldn't have a partisan agenda enacted, or you couldn't like pick off one member of the other side and say, okay, we got our majority. And that's been the complaint about a lot of these special committees in the past, is that, you know, people have been suspicious that they're being put in place to rush a partisan agenda into action, or maybe, you know, you can pick off one member of the other side. This would really force any plan that came out of this rescue committee to have bipartisan support.
And I think that's important, not just for developing solutions within the committee, but once the committee reports their solution, they're going to need to get the House and Senate and President to vote and sign whatever rescue bill they come up with. So I think for the broader House and Senate, it'll be important for them to see that the committee, the rescue committee, voted with substantial support from members of both parties within the committee. And that hopefully will help to some degree whatever rescue bill they come up with pass through the House and Senate and get signed by the president. All of this sounds very speculative and unlikely in these highly partisan times, but I think it's important to lay out a process by which we force Congress to address these issues. They are going to have to address them. These trust funds will run out. The programs will become insolvent. Large cuts will have to happen automatically. And any time you can get Congress to develop a process by which they can extend the life of those trust funds or really create, hopefully, some broader reforms for these programs, we really should encourage it and be encouraged by members of Congress trying to develop these processes.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your substitute host this week, Bob Bixby, and I'm talking with Josh Gordon, Executive Vice President and Director of Policy and Research at Free the Facts. We've been discussing the latest budget numbers, a new proposal to save the trust funds called the Trust Act, and we'll be right back after these short messages to hear more from Josh on his new position at Free the Facts. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm Bob Bixby, substituting for Chase Hageman this week. And we're picking up on our last segment with Josh Gordon, Executive Vice President and Director of Policy and Research at Free the Facts. Josh, we've been discussing some of the facts, the budget facts, and a proposal from a bipartisan group of House and Senate members to shore up the trust funds. But I wanted to turn now to your new role. People who have been listening to this podcast for some time and this radio show know that you've been the policy director of the Concord Coalition for something like 18 years,
yeah.
Quite a long time, and just recently left to join Free the Facts in a new role. And so I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about that and what your new role is and what Free the Facts is all about.
Well, thanks, Bob. Free the Facts is an organization that really is focused on educating college-age students. Really, age 14 to 35 is the demographic we focus on. And the idea is to bring them the policy discussions that we have in Washington onto their campuses in a way that they don't normally experience them. Most college students have told us that when they go to campus, they're really faced with a lot of partisan political debates, but they don't really get into some of the current policy debates that policymakers should be having here in Washington and don't have enough. So one of the main ways we do that is we go on a college tour. We go on a tour in the fall and the spring. And we're really kind of ramping up our visits on these college campuses. Last year, they did about 19 college visits in the fall and the spring. And this year, we plan to do about 40 visits in the fall and 40 in the spring. And next year, we hope to do almost twice as many. And what we do is we have a couple issue areas that we focus on, Social Security and Medicare, which are familiar to your listeners. And then we also have a new program we're doing on student loans and bringing that policy discussion to college campuses. What we're trying to do is just show these college students that there are ways to look at the facts that are nonpartisan. The facts are the facts. And we say that solutions are partisan, but we want them to understand what the different solutions could be. And we want to prepare them to have a policy discussion with people who may not agree with them on those solutions, but free from kind of partisan talking points.
Yeah, that sounds like a very worthwhile endeavor and very familiar because that was, going back to our fiscal wake-up tour that the Concord Coalition did between 2005 and 2010. You know, the whole premise of that was that we could travel around with people who were either conservative or more progressive think tank types. And the the shtick was that they all agreed on the facts. See, look at this. Look at a Democrat and a Republican here, and they agree on the facts. But it shouldn't be that difficult to agree on the facts. I mean, it's too bad that we have to focus on that. But when you can agree on the facts, then you can make, I think, then you make your arguments on policy, on ideology, or what you perceive to be the right role for the government, its size and its scope, and so. With the students, is there any idea of what they should do beyond this? Do you encourage them to get into activism role, or is it more just get yourself your mind in the right place to be a good citizen?
I think we look at these college tours on a dual track. The most basic track is, can we continually hold events on a college campus that bring students together to discuss policy in a, kind of partisan, pundit-free zone? So that's one goal. And then the other goal is we really have kind of a ladder of activism that we bring, where if a student really likes the presentation, they can sign on to become a Free the Facts ambassador on that campus and bring more events and policy scholars to campus to talk about other policy issues. And then if those ambassadors really like doing that, we offer them internships, and they can come to Washington and do an internship where they both work at Free the Facts, but also have some time to work for a non-paid internship doing some other policy area that they really love doing. And then we have ladders beyond that, where they can become a policy scholar and really do an intense research project around an issue that appeals to them. And the goal is to both foster discussion on campus, but also to encourage kind of a new generation of policy leaders who can experience policy debates from this fact agreed upon zone and aren't just coming to Washington to right away get into the partisan political fray. Because to solve a lot of these problems that Concord cares about and that Free the Facts cares about, we're going to need congressional staffers, member of Congress, who have kind of a reawakened sense of what it's like to have a policy debate about policy, as opposed to faking a policy debate that's really about partisanship. I think that's one of the most worrisome trends that we see in Congress, and that's been kind of keeping us from solving these really hard fiscal challenges and other challenges that the nation faces.
Yeah, I think that's a very good way of facing the future, you might say. I mean, when I look at our own activities at Concord, We also like to direct things. I'm thinking more and more so at really new leaders, the up and coming generation of the next leaders. And because it's, I don't want to say, giving up on the current crop, but I mean, you look at the what we were just talking about, the dysfunction. It's very difficult for me to conceive of people coming up with or even engaging in meaningful discussions right now. And so it is important to think about how the next group of leaders is trained to think about things, not in a kind of a rote partisan sense, but in a critical thought sense. It also occurred to me that some of these people might graduate into or have an interest in being fiscal lookouts at the Concord Coalition at some point, too. That's maybe an offshoot of your latter, if they get interested. So at a typical, on a college tour, what would an event look like?
So one of the types of events I've done most is an event about Social Security. And the really fun thing, and maybe this betrays my nerdiness, but being able to teach about Social Security, the program, to college students is just very exciting, because you go to college and you probably don't know much about Social Security. You don't know how pensions work. You don't know why the government is taking a certain amount of money directly from your paycheck. And being able to make that program real to college students, as well as letting them know that by 2035, the Social Security Trust Fund will be out of IOUs, we'll have to cut all benefits by 20%, and letting them know that this is on the horizon during their working life. They are either going to have to pay higher taxes or experience benefit cuts from the benefits that are currently promised. And letting them see how that all fits, why it's relevant to them, why it's relevant to their parents, kind of learn kind of the basics about why we even have the program in the first place, is really kind of interesting, and they get really engaged very quickly. I think the free food that we provide at our events probably helps with that. Also, I think our presentation, which always has at least one policy expert from around the country at it, as well as Free the Facts staff and an ambassador on that college campus who's interacted with Free the Facts before, I think that combination really makes these presentations work well and makes them engaging, and allows us to kind of work with these students to really understand what a policy discussion is like. The other thing we do is we like to work with organizations already on the campus. And a lot of times we are like the only presentation you get on a college campus that's sponsored by both college Republicans and college Democrats. And we kind of take pride in that bridging of those two poles on college campuses. And that's also a really exciting thing that we can bring.
I was going to ask you about that, because our experience has been, we always like to get Democrats and Republicans to cooperate on things. There have been occasions, though, where we almost have to work against them, either the college Democrats or the college Republicans, or maybe both view our activities with suspicion. But it is terrific when you can get them at least to agree on a set of facts and bring people out to the events. Although I must say the free food probably does help. We've resorted to that. It's a terrible thing to have to resort to free food, but I mean, you got to do what you got to do to bring the crowds out.
It slightly messes with your there's no free lunch message, but ultimately we take that in good fun and get the crowds into the seats.
Well, you just don't call it a free lunch. It's just a little free snack. Josh, it sounds really interesting, very, very compatible and consistent with your work at the Concord Coalition. If people want to know more about Free the Facts, how they could get involved, what should they do?
They can come to freefacts.org, look at our materials, and if you're on a college campus, there are ways to sign up and apply to be an ambassador, or at least look at our calendar and come to the next Free the Facts event we have on your campus.
Well, thanks a lot, Josh Gordon. Thanks for your 18 years at the Concord Coalition, and good luck in this new endeavor with Free the Facts, which sounds really interesting. This is Facing the Future. I'm your guest host this week, Bob Bixby, substituting for Chase Hageman. I've been talking to Josh Gordon, Executive Vice President and Director of Policy and Research at Free the Facts.
Thanks for having me.
We've been discussing the latest budget numbers, a new proposal called the Trust Act to deal with the depleting trust funds, and Josh's new role at the organization Free the Facts. You've been Facing the Future. Thanks for listening.